Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Have you ever read a book, seen a movie, or listened to a song and felt like there was something about it that someone wasn't telling you? And have you ever been alone and had that weird feeling that someone or something is watching? These are the things director Rodney Asher explores in his films Room 237 and The Nightmare. Hi, I'm Paco Romaine. George Chen and I sat down with Rodney to talk about his career, his films, and something called Kiki Wipes. Here's part one of our interview, and we'll follow it up with part two next week.
So we're here in Los Angeles with Rodney Asher. Hi, Rodney.
Yay. Hey, man. How's it going, guys?
Good. And you've got a cat on your lap.
I do.
A big fluffer.
I hear his name is Lloyd.
Lloyd Mosby. He was an outfielder for the Toronto Raptors.
Okay.
Toronto Blue Jays, and then the Detroit Tigers. So I thought, when I first moved in, I thought his name was Lord Mosby, because he's kind of fat and gouty, but... Then I found out different.
Yeah.
But you were just talking about living in San Francisco. Were you making films when you lived in San Francisco?
Yeah, making a lot of shorts and doing a lot of animation. I was working with a partner, Sid Garen, and we were actually doing a lot of stuff. There were a pair of digital film festivals that were traveling around back then, because this was like the late 90s, early zeros.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a lot of experiments with digital animation. I think the most notorious one we did was called Somebody Goofed, which was a very literal adaption of the Jack Chick comic tract.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
I don't think I've seen that one. Yeah,
it's around. You may have to dig a little. But there's actually a DVD called Hot Chicks, where there are 9 different adaptions of Jack Chick tracks, and me and Sid teamed up for 2 of them. Somebody Goofed, and we had gone our own ways by then, but we reunited to do a version of Jack Chick's Titanic.
Mm-hmm. And the kind of animation you're doing, so it's like early, late 90s, like what kind of programs is...
Lots of After Effects stuff.
After Effects.
You know, we were really early in the movement of making 2-dimensional photos look 3-dimensional by layering them into sort of paper dolls. We were into that before it was cool.
So like scanning stuff and then figuring out how to like articulate the joints.
Yeah,
and
kind
things.
Of making yeah. you know, jointing them at the elbows and at the head.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah,
like
that's
you would
cool.
you would cut a photograph into layers and then find ways to replace the gap so that you could both have the objects move around and you could do sort of a 3-dimensional depth and move a virtual camera around it.
Did you start with actual 2D like cutouts? And when I mean the style before this?
No, actually before that, you know, we had done live action, we had done we did a black and white prison drama with sock puppets about the early career of Henry Lee Lucas.
Oh.
I know the name. Who is that? Again?
He was the guy whose story they told in Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Oh yeah,
and we did a version of, because he was in prison for a while and then he got released, just because of prison overcrowding, and like no joke, he says to the warden, "I'm not rehabilitated. If you release me, I will kill again." And they released him, and he killed again.
Wow. And you made a short out of sock puppets.
Yeah, well, we built this, you know, big prison set. My wife's an architect, and she built this beautiful foam core prison set. And there's actually a big influence on that film was Todd Haynes' Superstar.
Oh, yeah, the Barbies.
The Barbie thing that he did with that Karen Carpenter.
That was huge when that came out. I mean, for an underground video.
Yeah. Well, and it's such an incredible movie, but, you know, for a lot of reasons. But, you know, what I really loved is there's kind of a joke about how it's set up. But after a while, that whole process becomes invisible, and you're just watching.
You're invested in
this tragic
Barbie
story.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I'm not going to say that our sock puppet prison drama is as, you know, significant and successful a short as Todd Haynes' Superstar. But, you know, part of our ambition was that, okay, yeah, it's funny to see, you know, sock puppets acting badly. But let's see how quickly we can just kind of forget that they're sock puppets and treat it seriously and get invested in it.
So going back with your story, so did you go to school for filmmaking? Where did you go to school?
I did. I went to school in Miami, at the University of Miami. Mm-hmm.
The U.
Huh?
The U.
The U, yeah.
You grew up in Florida?
I moved around a little bit. My family moved there when I was a teenager. You know, and back then I was working with Sid, who I did, you know, those projects with, and another friend, Marco. And we were as much into, you know, like punk rock music videos as we were into narrative film.
Yeah.
And so out of school, we were doing a lot of those kinds of projects. And then, you know, I was drawing storyboards for TV commercials or kickboxing movies and doing a lot of production assistant work.
Is there a lot of film work in Miami?
Back then, and we're talking the 90s, it was largely TV commercials.
Okay.
And, oh, right, because people want the visual backdrop, probably, of all like the...
Yeah, well, you know, there's good weather year-round, kind of like L.A. And every once in a while, like a big thing would come to town. You know, like I auditioned to do the storyboards for Jim Carrey's The Mask.
Wow, cool.
I didn't get it. But I did do them for a remake of Flipper that was directed by the guy who did one of my all-time favorite movies, Halloween 3.
Oh, nice.
Tommy Lee Wallace. And I was like, oh, my God, you directed Halloween 3.
And Flipper.
And he was doing Flipper. And this was, I think now, you know, history has caught up with it, and the general public has come to realize what a timeless classic Halloween 3 is. But back then, it was still, you know, not a shadow that I think he was trying to escape from.
Yeah. I know Jim Carrey, I think Ace Ventura is also in Miami, right?
Yeah, you know what?
It was Ace Ventura.
It might have been Ace Ventura.
Right, because
eyewitness testimony is unreliable.
And Ace Ventura is an amazing film.
Yeah. Were you around the music scene in Miami much? Did you ever go to like Churchill's?
Oh, I was there all the time.
Okay.
Well, and I did, me and Sid did a lot of video projections behind Marilyn Manson when he was starting out.
Did he start out in Florida?
Oh, yeah, hell yeah.
I thought he was like an Ohio kid for some
reason. Well, he traveled. I think he was born in Ohio, but he was living like in Fort Lauderdale or Boca Raton. There was a show he did. I had done a Super 8 film loop for this local band called The Goods, and I kind of taped it. And then after they went on, this guy comes on stage with one friend doing keyboards, and he had a Marilyn Monroe T-shirt on that he had written with a Sharpie Manson and drew on like a swastika on her forehead, and he had like a Barbie doll, like you do the hairdo kind of plastic head on a on a microphone like impaled on a microphone stand, and I'm like, well, this is interesting. Can I film this? And you know, I shot some high 8 of it, which I probably still have around,
like mid 90s.
You know, and then me and Sid kind of befriended them, and we were doing these crazy, you know, video projections and shot some old video stuff. Back in the day, man.
Yeah,
you had to be there.
Was he in the full makeup regalia at that point?
It was always I haven't looked at this tape in 20 years, but it was always a theatrical experience, even when, you know, his budget was $15 and the props, you know, came from Goodwill.
Yeah.
It was clear what his vision was.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and, you know, I think really out of anyone that I've ever met, he's somebody who had such a clear idea of what he wanted to do and just methodically made it happen.
Are you still in touch?
No, I haven't been in touch with him for 15 years. Yeah. Really since the first album came out, he kind of went off. He kind of went off, and you know, had his whole adventures. And I was in Miami for a while before I made it out to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, God love him.
Yeah.
And when you moved to San Francisco, did you work for ad agencies then, or did you do?
I did some. You know, we were doing some stuff. We were like directing TV commercials back then. Mm-hmm. You know, often stuff that had lots of graphics and animation in them.
Oh, that's cool.
So you just kind of learned the technology early on, and you were storyboarding a lot?
I was storyboarding and did some second unit stuff, and mm-hmm. me and Sid would do some of that together or some of it on our own. And mm-hmm. then we directed it was fun. Like, we kept thinking that was going to take off. Like, we would do like a video game commercial or something. And some of them would be kind of these cool, you know, kind of music video, kind of elaborate stuff. And then, like, another one wouldn't happen for, like, a year.
Right.
For, like, a year and a half.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, the devil would find other work for our idle hands.
And now, like, I feel like it's funny. You can make music videos and just throw them on YouTube, but I think the budgets must be smaller than they used to be.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a funny flip side of things. You know, it used to be that you could really make a good living making music videos, that there was a lot of money there, but anything other than the top level would be impossible to see.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Now you can see it all.
Now you can see it all, and even the, you know, really, you know, even the really lo-fi homemade stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I think I've been out of that world for a while, but mm-hmm. yeah, I think the budgets have come way down.
But I think that's part of the challenge, right? Like, is trying to make a little stretch out to look like a lot, like especially like set
although
design.
It's easier now, you know.
Yeah.
You know, technology being what it is, and even you can shoot high definition slow mo video on your phone.
Right.
You know, it's more about you know, the time that you put into it.
Is that you, Mama?
Emily Lucas.
But
you did
I killed
this
you.
To me.
No.
You bad
no.
Boy. I always told you
no,
you were
Mama,
destined
I'm
to
sorry,
die
Mama.
Like a dog
but,
in prison.
But I didn't mean it, Mama.
Now,
Mama, I
listen
didn't
to
mean
me.
It.
I no, want
Mama.
You to disobey
Mama,
the gods.
Please, I'm sorry, Mama.
Hurt
no,
people.
No.
And
no,
kill
Mama.
Yourself.
Please leave me
kill
alone,
yourself
Mama.
Kill yourself for Mama, Henry. Kill yourself.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Was there a particular time that you can remember when you transferred from, like, hobby filmmaking to, like, this is my living, this is what I'm...
Well, I mean, I've always made my living in the film business.
Gotcha.
But, you know, sometimes it was, you know, storyboarding, you know, serial commercials, you know, and sometimes it was literally shoveling the crap that came out of an elephant on the set of a phone book commercial, you know. You know, so
is that when the elephant stood on the phone book?
No, it was.
Or am I making
there,
something
there,
up?
There was some spot, you know, I where to demonstrate something, you know, two elephants were playing tug of war with a phone book to rip it in half.
Ah.
And it was harder than you might think. They had to, first they thought the elephants could do it and they couldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
And they had to keep cutting away and cutting away and cutting
away.
They had
to score the book.
Mm-hmm. But I think because of like the non-union rules in Florida, at a certain point during the day, it was my job to bring the elephant to the set. And I got to like spend some quality time with an elephant.
Yeah.
You know, and like play
with a trainer.
Right. I guess. I don't. You know what? I would. That's what would make sense in my memory.
There was no trainer.
In my memory, I don't see a trainer.
It's a non-union shoot.
I see. Then. I'm standing in front of the elephant, and I'm kind of playing with his trunk.
Oh wow!
is the way my neurons encoded it.
So, when you moved to San Francisco, you're still doing this ad work. When did you make the? I guess, do you see it as a transition into doing documentary from doing more like fictional animation stuff? Or what do you see?
To me, it all blurs together, you know? And 237, which, you know, came from the S from Hell, which was like a documentary short I did before. You know, there... Like, even when I was in school, I was doing projects where I was recutting archival footage, you know, to music or to different soundtracks.
Mm-hmm.
So 237 is called a documentary for lack of a better word, but you know, there's as much of an influence for me on by people like Bruce Conner, who mm-hmm. you know,
San Francisco
was a San Francisco fine artist, you know, mm-hmm. film artist, you know, who he did a lot of different things.
Yeah, he did photography also. Yeah,
it was some of the most significant things were the collage films that he made. You know, mm-hmm. probably the best known one being A Movie. Mm-hmm. He also did a cut up video for Devo and one for the Brian Eno David Byrne album, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. Mm-hmm. America's Waiting. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Oh, Bruce Conner did that.
Bruce Conner did the video for.
I didn't know he did a Devo video.
Yeah,
I wonder which one that is. It's not the one with Bougie Boy where he's like...
Mongoloid, where he's got the fork in the... It's from the era where he has the fork in the toaster.
The Mongoloid era, okay.
Yeah, it's like the first big record. You know, and it's mostly cut-up stuff, mm-hmm. if I remember right. You know, and you know, I'm also old enough to say cut-ups, like the William S. Burroughs.
Well, you started with VHS then, probably.
Oh, yeah,
right?
I remember doing
the double deck.
You pause.
Dubbing a tape, pretty much the same as dubbing tape.
Yeah.
Well,
that was really where I had my breakthrough in film school, because like the first couple of, you know, straightforward live-action projects I did were complete catastrophes.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had a work-study job in the law school. And there was usually nothing to do, so it was literally a prison where me and three or four guys had to sit in the office until our slots were over.
I've had jobs who felt like that.
And there was there was a whiteboard in the office mm-hmm. where the waiting list to sleep on the couch.
Whoa.
For the employees, yeah.
Yeah, so, but I discovered they had a video editing set up.
Oh, nice.
And we weren't doing any video editing in school. We were, you know, cutting film.
Oh, right. You were cutting film.
So I taught myself how to video edit. I would just bring mm-hmm. a brown shopping bag, you know, full of, you know, like $3 compilation videos of car crashes or, you know, World War II scenes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'd lay down a Sonic Youth track or a Ministry song or something, and you know, I would.
It's like that movie Tape Heads. Like
I would, you know, insert, edit, you mm-hmm. know, in time,
mm-hmm.
you know, the, you know, all my, you know, my favorite lurid videos, you know, from my collection.
It's like DJing.
Yeah,
it's like kind of like making a mixtape.
Well, and in fact, there was a club that we went to a lot, a music club. Mm-hmm. That was playing a lot of early industrial music, and they had a big video screen, and they would show weird movies, and I, you know, talk to the DJ, and then I would bring in tapes and show, you know, like an hour or long of these collages, you know, that were supposed to go to particular songs, but could really, you know, it could really play to anything,
mm-hmm.
you know. So when I was doing something like the S from Hell or Room 237,
mm-hmm.
it was drawing as much from that
right.
as it was from, you know, mm-hmm. my idea of documentary, and
mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of documentary, but going into those films,
mm-hmm.
I didn't have really any experience with that scene of filmmakers.
Yeah.
I've gotten to know some of them in the time since, mm-hmm. but you know, previously I was coming from, you know, another planet.
What inspired you to do S from Hell? Because I just watched that one.
I just watched it too. It's on Vimeo for anyways.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. I had actually, there was an earlier documentary that I had started and abandoned. Well, there's like a couple of pieces that I've kept as self-contained things about collectors,
okay.
about, you know, just really obsessive collectors. Mm-hmm. And in the research for that, you know, and I came across a guy who had a blog posting about his childhood phobia of the Screen Gems logo. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
And
which also looks like a 69. Yeah. You didn't even bring that. Did you think that at first?
Yeah. That's
no, but I'm not as sexually warped as you,
well,
George Chen.
Yeah, it's 6 and a 9 though, but the shape of it. Yeah.
Well, it looks like a yin yang, which is 69 too. Mm-hmm. And when I read this guy's blog posting, you know, it was like time travel. You know, I was 3 years old, and I was sitting on the rug in my grandparents' house, you know, watching 4 hours of TV on a Sunday morning, and being kind of confused by, like, that first wave of, like, proto-computer graphics, that early video animation, like the Electric Company.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
You remember when, like, the Today Show had this, like, weird, it almost looked like, I don't know. It was like a wipe almost. Like it was. You could see the letters of the Today Show all like look like an LSD trip. Mm.
That's awesome. I don't think I know that one in particular, but it's the kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know what you would call that, but
well, it might have been there's a machine that they used, and that like this one did. Like the logo for Battle of the Network Stars.
Oh, yeah.
And like a lot of TV news where there'd be like this kind of like disco animation of helicopters and like a city that would have like this laser edge of the silhouette.
Oh, yeah. That kind of, those kind of graphics.
And they called that the Scanimation.
Scanimation.
And there was this machine, and I found a documentary on it online that I bought, a DVD. There's a company called Image West who was out here. And the machine was like, you know, as big as this apartment, and it had, you know, more controls than a 747, and you would kind of guys would cut like some kind of film elements with an X-Acto blade, and they'd put it under glass, and they'd take an image of it, and it would get into the thing's memory bank, and then you could like move things, or you could move the layers and change the colors with like faders and you know, all sorts of analog controllers.
Yeah,
wow.
So it has a combination of
digital analog
and hard edges, and you can feel the human touch.
What was a toaster?
Video toaster? Toaster. Video toaster is awesome.
What was toaster
was...
no, and it's turning into interesting.
Oh, the Amiga. Go online and go on YouTube and look for the Amiga video toaster. I think it ran on an Amiga. Did it? The video toaster was an early... This is early 90s. Might have gone back to the late 80s. Mm-hmm. It was a video graphics... computer, and it was a big deal because both so nerdy before the video toaster.
It's a podcast. It's fine.
Yeah.
Simultaneous to the video toaster, you know, there was like the what was it called? The Chiron.
Oh, right, Chiron.
Like there were these, you know, to do graphics for a television show, you would sit in a room that looked like the bridge of the Enterprise, and you would pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars an hour to watch a guy like click through like the half dozen fonts that they had loaded on the machine, and say, and then which of these 12 colors do you want it to be? And the video toaster did all that stuff on a desktop.
Okay.
And it came in with like these early like transitions. So you could do like the wipes like Star Wars, and you know, man, fans of the video toaster would get would feel a lot of nostalgia for. They called them Kiki wipes,
okay?
Because there was this woman who was a superstar in the video toaster scene,
of course.
And her name was Kiki. Her last name might have been Stockhammer or something like that. And she's a really interesting person because. She was like, and again, this is the way I think I remember it. She was both, you know, an engineer who designed all this software, but she was also kind of a model, like a fashion model. And had like beautiful long red hair, and she was always like super, super stylish. Mm-hmm. So she would film herself in silhouette. like almost like a James Bond girl, wiping across the screen or like kicking up with her legs as transitions between different layers of video.
That James Bond thing.
Yeah, you know, only be like a purple video, like kind of lo-fi video
and that was
silhouette.
A transition filter?
Yeah, you know, so
woman silhouette.
Yeah, you know, so you know, you're watching, you know, image A, you're, you know, watching image A, and then a silhouette that's filled, a silhouette of, you know, a woman kicking up with high heels. That's got image B, you know,
that
would wipe through it to introduce the other shot. You know, video toasters would, you know, people who had video toasters would tend to go a little overboard with the transit. Like every shot would have a, you know, every shot of your skate video or, you know, whatever would have this, you know, the shots would get mapped onto a cube that tumbles.
You could do it. That's one of those things where the technology is there. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should.
People always go a little bananas. Yeah. And it's hard to blame them. You can be like a kid in a candy shop with a new toy.
Well, totally, yeah. And I think a lot of the electric company people, if I'm not mistaken, those are like CalArts people. I think there's a huge animation department at CalArts.
Oh, you know what? That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
so I've never made that connection. My wife went to CalArts.
Okay.
And I know like that's where like the whole Pixar scene and Tim Burton comes from there.
Yeah. And a lot of the people that worked on Star Wars, the early special effects for Star Wars, I think.
I always thought
the
electric company was out of New York for some reason.
I don't know why.
Well, Image West, who did the Scanimation, did do some Star Wars stuff.
Okay.
I've got this great video where the dudes who run it are like in a are sitting in these kind of space chairs and they're green screened into outer space and they're dressing, it seems like a trade show. It looks like they're addressing investors. You know, and they're like, you know, the future for this technology is going crazy, and every year we're getting bigger and bigger and better. And last year we worked on a little movie you might have heard of called Star Wars.
It was like introducing the concept of a green screen to people, kind of, right?
Yeah.
Or,
well,
just, or that you hire their hire Image West to do your stuff.
Well, you couldn't those guys couldn't just shoot themselves in an office.
They had to be
flying through outer space. You know, they were pretty amazing.
Yeah.
They look kind of like the music engineers in Boogie Nights.
Oh yeah,
like they were really hip guys.
They have little Coke spoons on the end of their necklaces.
I could sense a little of that.
So when did you move to L.A. and did you start making? Did you make S from Hell before you moved to L.A.?
I was already here.
You're already down here.
Well, I was starting to spend more and more of my time here while we were still living in San Francisco. And
that sounds familiar to us.
Yes.
That's pretty much what we're doing.
What we're doing.
You know, and then at a certain point, I was doing all my work here, and my wife went to grad school at CalArts.
Oh, yeah.
So so we made the move.
To do architecture? Is that what she does?
Yeah, well,
design.
She does architecture and fine art. I think it was like 2001, 2002-ish.
Okay. A while ago.
You know.
I noticed you have Josh Fadum.
Oh, yeah. Josh is amazing.
Yeah. He did our podcast.
Oh, cool.
We talked about the Up series, Michael Apted's documentary, the Up series.
Yeah.
And you had Adomian, too, right?
Yeah, I've done a couple things with him. He's great.
I saw him in the credits, too, yeah.
I also saw Blaine Capatch's name in the soundtrack for S from Hell.
Well, the soundtrack from S from Hell, I mean, everything. I did a video with Josh. He had this character that was kind of like a parody of Freddy Krueger in a way, where, you know, he was presenting himself as kind of like a boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
Only his way of scaring people was by reaching into a garbage bag and pulling out an old VHS tape and talking about how scary the movie was. And we did a video of it. We did a short for it that was kind of modeled on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a long time ago. One of the things I did when I moved to LA, the UCB had just opened, and I was fascinated by you know, their whole process. So, you know, I never had any ambition to be a performer, but I took a couple of improv classes to try to understand the theory.
Mm-hmm.
And just because it seemed like, hey, I'm a fan of this stuff. And this is an amazing opportunity. And that's where I met Josh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we stayed in touch and, you know, have done a couple things together, but,
But Blaine Capatch is also San Francisco.
Yeah, well,
comic.
The thing about point. that soundtrack, the thing is, the soundtrack in the S from Hell, the music is a live recording of Blaine and Amit Eidelman, because they have a band called the Tulsa Skull Swingers.
Oh, yeah. Ron Lynch is a drummer in that, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And the idea was, like, Josh performed his character. Before we did the video, I saw Josh perform his character at Steakhouse, the French plate restaurant on Sunset, T-A-I-X.
Did you have a comedy show there? Okay.
They did a Tulsa Skull Swinger show.
That's a great name.
And at a certain point, Josh came on stage and he did his character, and they played music behind, and it was kind of like atonal, like feedback and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was important for me because we had talked about the character and we're trying to think about what the video was going to be like, and how much of a joke it should be or how seriously we should treat it. And when I saw him do it with them and that they were playing music that was genuinely scary, it sounded kind of like, you know, the end of a Bauhaus song, when it kind of dissolves into, you know, kind of noise. You know, that really suggested we should try to, the more seriously we take it, the funnier it'll be.
Which is also a role of improv. That's also one of the things about, you learn in the improv world.
Yeah.
Or at least UCB, yeah.
So we didn't wind up using it, but Josh recorded Blaine and Amit just making some of that music. It was destined, it was recorded to be the soundtrack for Visions of Terror, that video that I did with Josh. Didn't wind up making sense for it, but I repurposed it for the soundtrack for The S from Hell.
Okay.
So which is a story that's going to make sense to like three people.
Yeah.
but those three people might say, now I get it. All right.
Screen Gems, a subsidiary of Columbia Pictures, was formed in 1939, initially to release animated cartoons. For decades, its name was presented as if carved from marble alongside the Columbia Torch Lady. This title treatment followed every Screen Gems production, seemingly without incident. In 1964, the company was rebranded with a newly designed modern logo accompanied by an 8-note synthesized melody composed by Eric Sade. This pairing caused widespread fear and unease in an entire generation of TV-watching children. To this day, it's known as the S from Hell.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
You seem to be really good at finding people that have very specific, weird things in their lives, like the Screen Gems music that makes them feel weird, or the Room 237 people with their opinions or nightmare. How do you do that yourself? Do you have a producer that does that?
Well, you know, I did the S From Hell by myself. I found those guys. For Room 237, I had a partner, a producer, Tim Kirk, and we researched that together and found the people together.
What was the impetus to that? Like, how did you? did it come from you? Like, I wonder if people think The Shining has ulterior motives, or did you?
Well, it actually, came from Tim. Found an essay that Jay Widener wrote. You know, saying that The Shining is Stanley Kubrick's confession for having faked the moon landing.
Okay. And so that is one of the people you interviewed.
And he's in the film. Yeah, yeah. And I read that, and I don't think he sent it to me thinking that there's a feature, there is a commercially releasable feature film in this idea.
Scorpio 1 or whatever that movie about faking the moon landing was.
Oh, there's like three of them now.
Yeah.
Did he call you and be like, I need you to sit down, I have a great idea?
No, but I read it, and first I thought that it would be a good follow-up to The S From Hell, which inexplicably got really, you know, kind of blew up for me, and it played at Sundance. And
2010, S From Hell?
Yeah, 2010. Mm-hmm. So first I thought just doing that story might be a interesting follow-up to The S From Hell. And like, similarly, I read that story, and it kind of gave me the creeps. Uh-huh. And I kind of said, wow, now this makes sense.
Which part?
Well, you.
That was a big question. Is like, which theories do you feel?
You're never going to get a straight answer from me about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I read this idea, and it was probably late at night. And the thing about it is, like, even what we show in the film, it's like four times more complicated than that. And there's, at a certain point, the accumulation of detail becomes really, really persuasive. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, one thing that we didn't have time to get into was the fact that, let's see, how does this work? The two girls in The Shining were from the family that lived in the hotel before the Torrances.
Oh,
right!
Immediately before them,
they were the Omen. They're the Omen girls,
right?
Another word for twin is Gemini, and that was the mission that preceded Apollo. You know, so there's like a half dozen more of those, stuff starts to add up, and it gets really persuasive. And it's that you're teetering on the edge of, this can't be true, but maybe it is true. Yeah. What does that mean?
Which is like all conspiracy theories. That's kind of the basis for a lot of. It's like knowing. Having evidence that confirmation bias.
Immersion critique. Have you heard that?
I haven't heard that.
There's that amazing article that Chuck Klosterman wrote about 237. And I think he used the word, if that's what you're talking about.
Yes, I read that review. It was really good.
I'll say.
Yeah, he really. Yes.
Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah, he really loved Room 230. And it was I read before that. I'm not pointing to anything. Before that review, I read Roger Ebert's, and then I think Slate Magazine.
Yeah, well, Ebert himself didn't write it. Didn't write a review.
Right.
Which is too bad. Because I did. He mentioned it. He died right before.
Right around the same time.
Yeah. I forget that he used a single word, which was probably a good word, but it was another guy from the site who wrote, and it was weird on the Roger Ebert site, because first a guy wrote an article, trying to decide whether or not the movie was a hoax or a joke, and you know I'm happy for people to entertain whatever ideas they want, but he hadn't seen the movie. So he was using other clues.
Oh, that's weird.
You know, which is an awesome. Well,
was it a review?
Not exactly.
That's strange. I mean, it seems like you'd have to watch the film to write a review about.
Well, it wasn't exactly. It was an attempt. Well, I kind of love it actually. The more I think about it, the more I like it. Mm-hmm. It was an attempt to understand whether the movie was a joke or whether the movie was serious by someone who hadn't seen it, but who had read about it and looked at other stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what was the conclusion?
We're not going to get a straight
answer. No, it's not that you're not going to get a straight answer.
His version.
I think he thought it was a joke.
Oh, okay.
I think. He also thought my name was Robert.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's it.
I think someone pointed this out. It might have been Bill that pointed out. Everything in room 237, there is no footage that is not taken from something, either the movie or from something else. Where S from Hell, you do have the live action scene.
There's live action in 237.
There is live action.
Oh, yeah, and there's animation.
There's definitely animation. I'm trying to remember, what are the live action scenes?
Well, there's a... I'm sorry.
No, tell you if you remember. You go. You tell them.
I'm sorry. I'm like, let me answer this one,
okay,
George.
Maybe this is just...
There's a point when a reenactment of
the cans.
Of the can, of the Calumet can.
Oh,
is,
that's
is
right,
going
yeah.
up.
Yep, that's
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
That's one. So uh-huh.
There is a sort of dignified butler who holds out a postcard, the invitation to the New Year's Eve party. Uh-huh. There is a hand opening up a box of DVDs that had just come from Amazon.
Right. When he orders 2001 and The Shining on the DVD.
Yeah. So there's
okay. There's some.
It's not a lot.
Yeah.
but there's a couple.
Okay. I mean maybe I heard that wrong or that was someone.
The reason the Calumet can stood out for me was I was wondering if that was you, in it, putting the can up. Is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
Is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was shot in my garage.
Oh yeah, sweet. Yeah. Nailed it.
Yeah.
Because my dad grew up in Calumet, Indiana.
Okay.
There's a little side.
Synchronicity.
Yeah, a little side note to that.
That movie has a way of generating them.
Well, that book, too. I mean, did you read the book?
Sure.
Yeah, prior to making the doc.
Or midway through it.
Oh,
okay. I kind of reopened
Stephen
it.
Stephen King.
Stephen King version. And then I like that you do mention the 217 versus the 237. I'm glad that you put that in there because I also just read an interview, and you may have gotten it from the same interview, I don't know, but an interview, Stanley Kubrick interview where they talk about The Shining. He mentions that the hotel asked him to change the number.
Yeah, no, I read that interview. I don't think there's an audio.
No, I read it, yeah.
I totally read it. And... you know, it's funny, like, you know, me and Tim would try to piece it together. And Jay called up the hotel and asked if there was a room 237 or a room 217. I think he asked if there was a 217 and they said no. At this point, you know, a couple years out now, I don't remember the details. But as we were trying to investigate the story, everything I had multiple possibilities, you know, like on the one hand, the story that Kubrick told about changing the room could be true. It could also not be true. You know, it could be that he changed it for some other reason.
Right.
Even if it is true, you know, and for me, I guess I've seen that interview and I've heard a confirmation. There's been some other newer confirmation more recently, even though it's a pretty small detail. I was skeptical of that story because on the one hand, I'm like, what, does he give the manager of the hotel who he takes a helicopter exterior of, like, script approval?
Yeah, right, right.
You know, since when? But
that's,
you know,
interesting.
Arguably, dude read the book. Of course, you know, a follow-up question could be, there is an almost infinite number of other numbers he could have picked besides 217 and 237. Mm-hmm. Just because... you know, 237 is not the only number that's not 217.
That is true.
If you want, if you want,
there's a room 235.
There's a room 218.
Yeah.
There's a room 317.
Is it a prime number? Are they prime numbers? I feel like 237, but probably both of those.
It's certainly an unsymmetrical number.
Yeah, yeah, that is true.
You know, and there are lots of ideas about what that number could mean. But you know, I think we were overthinking the. Both the Kubrick interview about the hotel manager, but also, you know, Jay calling up the hotel, and it's like, well, they might have told him the truth.
Right.
They might have also have said, I'm sick of these Shining fans calling about that room.
Yeah.
And could have some untrue story, which is their new policy.
Uh-huh.
They could have been messing with him.
Right.
You know, so there's just almost an infinite possibilities of explanations and counter explanations, but I'm going to go back to the simplest one being, if it's true, and it's probably true, that the hotel said we don't want there to be a stigma about one of the rooms in our hotel, he still could have picked a ton of there's something about that number, 237, that he liked.
You can find Room 237 and The Nightmare on Netflix. Thanks for listening. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate. For show notes or more about Paco and George's appearances, visit supdocpodcast.com. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook at SupDocPodcast. We'd also like to thank Documentary News for their continued support. Please check out documentarynews.com. This show is produced by Will Scovel and our theme music by David Siegel.